Welcome to The Final Word, a Bible teaching ministry with pastor, teacher, and author Jim Andrews. The Final Word is grounded on the invincible conviction that what the Bible teaches, God teaches. And that is the last word. On this program, truth still matters. The Bible is in, Babel is out. The Final Word is funded by listeners like you. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about the program, please go to our website at thefinalwordradio.com. There you'll find archives so you can listen to any program you may have missed. Visit us on our social media platforms at The Final Word Radio and write us a note. We love hearing from our listeners. We'll provide other contact information at the end of the program, so have your pen ready. And now Jim Andrews continues his current study of God's Word.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us again on The Final Word. Before I launch today's exposition, I want to make our listening audience aware of not only the books that I have authored, but some articles that I have written that you might be interested in, and tell you how to access them. Over the years, I have done a good deal of writing, as time allows, to prepare resources that I think should be helpful to my congregation and also helpful to you, our listeners. If you will go to jimandrewsbooks.com, that's one word, jimandrewsbooks.com, you will find there information describing the books I have authored, one of them co-authored with my daughter. On top of that, on the same website, you'll see a tab that says Articles. If you will open that with your cursor, you will discover there are some articles that I've produced over the years that you may find interesting and helpful. For example, one of the most recent articles was my take on the demise of the culture wars and where I think we ought to go from here. Another article that appeared several years ago in a journal for biblical manhood and womanhood is entitled Boundaries Without Bonds. Another is a rebuttal of a tract that appeared several years back. The author attempted cleverly, but as I will show unsuccessfully, to persuade us that the Scriptures do not condemn homosexual practice after all. That has all been a misunderstanding. Well, there will be others, but I mentioned those three. I'm not a regular blogger, but when sometimes things pop up on my radar that I feel I would like to address in a thoughtful way, I will sometimes produce a longer article like some of these. We continue our exposition of 2 Samuel. We are about to come to chapter 3, but not quite. I was making some points about the material in the last half of chapter 2 that we need to finish. Very important points. I was saying that in approaching all biblical narrative, especially a patch of text like this one from chapter 2, verse 12 to the end, and really the larger compass, chapter 2 through chapter 6, when we approach material like this, we must differentiate between what the text is telling us and what the text is teaching us, or at least can teach us. The narrator, by the way, it was not Samuel. We said he was dead at this time. But the narrator, inspired by the Spirit of God, superintended by the Spirit of God, he was purpose-driven in the way he selected his historical materials. He doesn't tell us everything we want to know. He leaves out a lot. Sometimes there are little details we wonder why they're so important, and they're big pictures. We wonder why he leaves those out. But all of this is dictated by the Holy Spirit. But when I read a narrative like this, I said I always ask myself, why did the author, the human author, why did he decide to include this material? What's the function that he has in the whole, and what is it teaching? And remembering, in the words of Leland Ryken, whom I mentioned, that narrative teaches by indirection, that is, the narrator does not usually tell us, the reader, in advance what he's wanting us to see or learn, but he so writes, colors, and shapes his narrative that his message comes through by means of internal clues for the alert reader. Well, one of his objectives, I didn't say his whole objective, but one of his objectives in this patch of narrative that we are currently looking at is what might be called an apology or a defense for King David. The Saul regime, we said, and all this is review, had made a pariah of David, falsely. But nevertheless, David was painted, officially, by the Saul regime, not Jonathan, but by Saul, as a subversive of Saul's throne. Now, all that was a figment of Saul's jealousy and paranoia. Doesn't matter, however, because lies have a way of sticking to the flypaper whether people are innocent or not. And if you've ever been a victim of them, you certainly know that. And not everybody, unfortunately, sees through them. And that would be especially true in this historical narrative and situation of the northern tribes, because there was already a bias. There was an ingrained jealousy of the tribe of Judah to which David belonged. So the Spirit of God, through the human author, aims to set the record straight about the integrity of David in his conduct after his ascension to the throne in all matters relating to Saul and his house. And in his integrity, we see a correlation between David's virtue and God's favor upon David, in sharp contrast with the character of Saul. Now, just as the last program was expiring, I was saying this. There's a good lesson for us folks in all of this. We, God's people, are not immune from vicious lies. We're not immune from the smears of people with bad intentions. However, it is remarkable, and here's an example, how God works to keep lies from sticking and how he rescues unjustly damaged reputations. The text tells the whole truth about David, and when David sins, it's in bold letters. But there was no sin with regard to the house of Saul. And here is the Spirit of God protecting David and protecting his reputation. I remember one of the scariest moments that ever happened in my ministry. I became a pastor right out of seminary at age 25. I don't really remember, but I'm guessing I was probably 28, still young and plenty done. But we had a young couple. I had presumably led to Christ, but one of those was a very doubtful case, as it turned out. They had been in our church and were an active part of our body, and then they moved, as I recall, about 30 miles down the road. In West Virginia, that's usually a long way and beyond accountability. But turned out that this young wife had some problems, big problems. When she moved 30, 35 miles away, as I say, I don't recall the distance, been much too long now, she wanted to paint herself as a very alluring young woman. So alluring, in fact, she spread the word that she had had an affair with the pastor of the Poca Baptist Church. One evening, one Wednesday evening, I heard of this. One of my men pulled me aside who worked at a plant about halfway between the two cities. He said to me, "Jim, I want to tell you something I heard." One of my coworkers came up to me today and asked me, said, "Martin, you live up in Poca, don't you?" And he said, "Yeah." I said, "Why do you want to know?" He said, "You go to church up there, right?" This was a fellow that I led to Christ also. And he said, "Yes. Well, we've got a woman down in our town who's saying that she's had an affair with that pastor up there." I'm telling you, I must have turned white on the spot. My heart almost hit my socks, because I knew there was no defense against this kind of thing. People can say anything they want to say and be as unaccountable as they want to be, but how in the world could I ever survive this? And it so happened that at that time, I was having a big problem in my church because I had refused to marry a certain believer to a certain unbeliever, and it was a politically connected family, and it was causing me all kinds of problems. And boy, all my enemies needed was to get hold of that. And I figured right there my goose was cooked. Do you know, I never heard another word about that. And I can't recall much more astounding than that, that I never heard a word about that. That thing was dropped like a hot rock. It never reappeared. God has a wonderful way of protecting us when we need to be protected. And he protected David, and this narrative is an example of that. So that's one reason for this narrative, to show the antecedents and the eventual murder of Abner, and also that David was not at fault in any way, but to show through this narrative, to mirror through this narrative, that David was justly outraged by the murder of Abner, which is coming up later in the narrative, and had every reason to be. So this is an important backstory for what's ahead in the narrative. But as I say, I think there's a great lesson for us about the way that God has of protecting the reputation of his servants, even after they're long gone, just as he has no compunction about exposing and punishing their sins, as he did in the case of David later. Like the sun breaking through the clouds, God causes the truth to shine through the fog of lies and slander. As I mentioned, narrative teaches by indirection, in the words of Leland Ryken. So one has to read the lines, and you also, in narrative, have to read between the lines. And you have to notice the atmosphere of a given text, that is, the feel of it, that the author has created by the way he narrates the facts. You will notice, for example, in this battle narrative that we saw here in chapter 2, there's a certain casualness, a certain hardness in his relating of the events, not on his part, but on the part of the participants. To back up just a little, note how the bloodshed was treated as sport. Proverbs 10:23 says, doing wickedness is as sport to a fool. In this evil world, war is sometimes necessary. I get amused at some of these bumper stickers I see where people say, war is not the answer. I look at one of those and I think, oh, you poor, helpless, naive fool. What would you recommend, dear? And it's usually a lady. What would you recommend? We do have enemies. We do have people who want to kill us. Remember 9/11? Remember Hitler? Remember Stalin? Remember Pearl Harbor? Of course we would rather not have war. But sometimes in this evil world, there really is no viable alternative. To go around with blind eyes like that, one wonders what planet some people were born on. In this evil world, war is sometimes necessary. It's never good. It's never pleasant. There's no question that war is degrading. There's no question that war blunts and dulls the edges of the humanity of man to man. No question. There's no question that war has a tendency to brutalize the moral sensibilities of those who are forced to engage in killing. But I'm certainly not saying there's always a peaceful alternative. There is not. For some will accept peace on the price of enslaving those they wish to dominate and plunder. Resistance is sometimes absolutely necessary. Nevertheless, the reality is in this sin-stained and darkened world, savaging one another has a way of defacing our humanity and making us more like the rest of the animal world. No question. We see that here, in this narrative, the almost casual way war was waged, as if a soccer game, and we see a hardness in the sheer bloodlust of the combatants. I think the narrator means for us to sense that and to be repelled by man's inhumanity to man, as necessary as sometimes it is. It was an ugly scene, brother against brother, needless bloodshed and brutality in this case. It is more than a commentary on the bitterness and the heartlessness of fallen human nature when the blood is up, as the saying goes. But more specifically, the narrative goes to show how messed up human affairs can get when people who know better refuse to get in line with God's plan. That was Abner. And in this case, a lot of people unnecessarily died for Abner's stubborn desire to hang on to his place of power, and not only his pride, but his fear of losing his life when the people of David replaced the house of Saul. Not a good thing. Joab, on the other hand, is a story of his own. We see how a human being can get hardened to bloodshed so that it becomes for them an adrenaline rush and almost a form of ultimate sport. It just goes to show the latent viciousness at the bottom of our fallen nature. You can look at Abner, you can look at Joab and say, wow, those guys were bad. But given the right circumstances, that badness is in all of us. It's latent, and circumstances can bring it out, but for the grace of God. War in this fallen world may be necessary at times, I've said that, but it is, I repeat, in any case, a degrading evil. There's nothing romantic about it, for it has a way of hardening the hearts of human beings and making the taking of human life a littler thing than it is. Like many power brokers in our churches, Joab was a man stained with enough religion to fake the part, but he didn't have enough of it to deeply take the part. Joab was not a hypocrite in the usual sense of the term, a man consciously faking it, I mean. He was just a man superficially religious, kind of the way Saul had been. Unlike David, the piety of Joab did not go to the bone of his being. Unlike David, whatever piety he had did not radicalize him in any way. Joab was one of those a little dab will do you kind of people that are so common among men who are religious. At bottom, Joab was just a worldling, except in the ritualistic and ceremonial sense. He was a nationalist. He was not a saint. He was a patriot, not a man of piety. And boy, there are a lot of those today. Folks, love your country. I love my country. But don't ever confuse patriotism for spirituality. They're not the same. God is not the great American in the sky. Get over that. Heaven doesn't have the Christian flag on one side of the platform and the American flag on the other side of the throne. Ridiculous. Patriotism is not spirituality. On the way back to Hebron from the battle, we read at the end of chapter 2, the forces of Joab pause long enough to honorably bury Asahel in Bethlehem in his father's tomb. It's a good reminder that those who live and die honorably deserve to be remembered honorably by the living when they pass. It's just a reminder that our debt to the living does not necessarily end when they die. It's one thing to die, but it's a disgrace to be forgotten by those whom we leave behind. We owe something to the memory of those who helped us when they were living. Thus, as hardened and calloused as they were, as immune to the sight of blood as these people were, they did not leave his body on the battlefield to rot, to be consumed by the birds and the beast. It was not a public health issue. It was a matter of public honor and respect for the dead, and especially those who had fallen in honor. So they took up the body of Asahel, and they buried him in his father's tomb, which was in Bethlehem. And Joab and his men went all night until the day dawned and came to Hebron. Well, we read in 2 Samuel chapter 3, verse 2, now, there was a long war between the house of Saul and the house of David. David grew steadily stronger, but the house of Saul grew weaker continually. Here's a summary statement of a long, drawn-out conflict between the two rival houses in Israel. The combat in the last chapter was just an opening shot, so to speak, but it was a battle reflecting declining strength in the case of the Saulite regime and the gathering strength of the forces of David under Joab, his captain. And all of this was orchestrated by God. Let's never lose sight of that. The protagonist of these narratives is God. David is just his servant. God may have an announced purpose, but he works his purposes usually and for various reasons, not always evident to us, in circuitous ways, that from our standpoint, to use that word again, may appear messy. But in the chaos and seeming randomness, there's always a hidden divine order, for our God is an orderly God, whether we can trace his hand or not. One of the great qualities of David is that in his trials, God had taught David better than most to take what God had given him at any given time, not to be too impatient to bring into being all that God had promised him, not to get ahead of God, but simply to stay the course, to let the Lord work things out in his time. God was, David knew, as good as his word. Stay the course and stay on his page. And David did that very well. Beginning in verses 2 through 5 of the third chapter, our author gives us a roster of wives that David acquired during his 7-year reign over Judah in Hebron. That was before the Lord worked things out when he reigned over all of Israel in Jerusalem for the last 33 years or so of his monarchy. Sons were born to David at Hebron. His firstborn was Amnon by Ahinoam, the Jezreelitess. His second, Kileab, by Abigail, the widow of Nabal, the Carmelite. The third, Absalom, the son of Maacah, the daughter of Talmai, the king of Geshur. The fourth, Adonijah by Haggith. The fifth, Shephathiah, the son of Abital. And the sixth, Ithream, by David's wife Eglah. These were born to David at Hebron. The question is, why are these wives and these sons mentioned at this point? Well, as I mentioned back in chapter 2, lineage, most particularly royal lineage, with its implications for royal succession, was important to chroniclers. It was something that should always be put on the record. Well, that raises the question, but why here seems to interrupt the narrative? Probably because the author wants right up front to give us a head start on some of the people who will, over the course of David's reign, be leading actors and people in conflict in the whole great drama that was the royal house of David. Some of these offspring became important players in the drama. Others are obscure members of the house of David or unknown altogether. I think Kyle and Dalich in their commentaries are probably correct in seeing this listing as one evidence of the growing power of the house of David measured by the metrics of the time. For we must consider that some of these marriages were not for love, but rather they were political alliances which rendered David more formidable as a foe. There is a lesson here, however. Such polygamous arrangements were more or less protocol among royalty in those days, even though Deuteronomy chapter 17, verse 17, warns future kings against multiplying wives, lest those foreign wives turn the heart of Israel's regents, like they did Solomon's, away from the Lord. So while God, he didn't approve, tolerated this evil, he chastened it by letting polygamy have all of its evil consequences to train Israel in time to better domestic habits. Again, God's purpose worked out from the human standpoint in a messy way. David was not immune to those outcomes in terms of palace intrigues and jealousies, and even incest and murder and conspiracies against his own throne. You see, folks, once bad habits get deeply ingrained in cultural practices, it's not easy just to command them to cease and desist. In this one, God seems to have chosen to let men have their way and suffer the consequences long enough that eventually the practice started to die under its own weight of penalties. In any event, God's purposes are gradually working themselves out toward the promised goal, that is, to establish the house of David forever over the whole house of Israel. It was slower than David thought when Saul perished on Mount Gibeah, but wisely, we say again, David bides his time, and he patiently waits for his sovereign God to put the pieces in place. Folks, there was once an occasion in the Old Testament when God literally told Joshua and Israel to stop praying, Joshua 7:10, and to start fixing a sin problem in the camp. There were other times when God told his servants, David, to stand still, for he told him the battle is the Lord's. The point is, seek God's will in every case. Don't run ahead of God. Don't lag behind either. Trusting in his all-wise direction at all times is the key. The Spirit of God knows how to inform us whenever the answer is not already in his revealed word. Now comes a major turning point in the demise of the house of Saul. The flashpoint was a rift between Abner, Saul's commander, who is now propping up Saul's weak successor, Ishbosheth. We read, "And it came about," verse 6, chapter 3, "that while there was war between the house of Saul and the house of David, that Abner was making himself strong in the house of Saul." Turns out that Saul had a concubine whose name was Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah. And Ishbosheth said to Abner, "Why have you gone in to my father's concubine?" Well, at that point, Abner was very angry over the words of Ishbosheth, and he said, I'm going to paraphrase, "Who the heck do you think I am? Am I some dog's head that belongs to Judah? Here I come along and I show kindness to the house of Saul your father, to his brothers and his friends, and I've not delivered you into the hands of David? And yet, today, you're brazen enough to charge me with guilt concerning the woman? Let me tell you something. May God do so to Abner and more also. If, as the Lord has sworn to David, I do not accomplish this for him to transfer the kingdom from the house of Saul and to establish the throne of David over Israel and over all Judah, from Dan to Beersheba." Ishbosheth could no longer answer Abner a word because he was afraid of him. And now we're coming to that point where, at the end of 7.5 years, God's purpose is about to reach its fruition, and David is about to become the king over all of Israel. Thank you, dear friends, for joining us on The Final Word. God bless you, and have a wonderful day.
The Final Word is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about this program, please visit our website at thefinalwordradio.com. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. Our email address is info@thefinalwordradio.com. Our phone number is 503-699-9840. If this program has ministered to you, tell a friend about it. We do solicit your prayers for God's hand upon this outreach.